So now they're caught in two dilemmas. One, they're not looking to the New Testament or to what God says to give them information. Two, they are ignoring what God says in the Old Testament. And if you're going to practice the Old Testament, you need to practice it all. You can't just pick and choose. That's it in a nutshell. So, all right. We are finishing up, maybe not today, but in a study of the chronological study of the life of Jesus by Gene Taylor. And we should be done with it here shortly. It's been a long study, but I think it's been profitable. Was asking the question a moment ago, where to from here? The suggestion was made possibly the book of James. Are there any other suggestions? Women of the Bible? That might be a better discussion for a women's class than for this one, to be very honest. I turned that off. Only because it would allow, I'm going to have a different viewpoint and take different things away from it than what maybe the ladies might. And so it's not that it's not a good study, because it's a fantastic study. It's probably just not a study that's best for me to look at it. Anyone else? We're talking about where to next. We've had a suggestion of James. Anybody else have any thoughts? Because we're going to be done with this pretty quick. Charles? Peter? Which book? Yes. Okay. Anyone else? So why don't we do this then? How many epistles did Paul write that we know of? He wrote 13, possibly 14, if he wrote the book of Hebrews. And many scholars think that he was at least part and parcel to the book of Hebrews. But he wrote 13. We've had a study in the book of Hebrews since we've been here. So after Hebrews, we see James, 1st and 2nd Peter, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and Jude. Okay, so the non-Pauline epistles. So we'll start with James, and we'll just work our way straight through all of those. How's that? Does that sound like an idea? So I'll start getting things put together for the book of James. And we're not going to spend 3 years in that study. We will go through them somewhat quickly. Okay. We've been talking about, after Christ arose from the grave, from the dead, what did he do for the next 40 to 50 days? He appeared to different people. And how Taylor has it is he has it broken down in his lesson 26, the first and second appearances, the third and fourth appearances, the fifth appearance, the sixth appearance. We're on question 13, which is on the backside of lesson 26, under what he calls the seventh appearance. Here's the point. These are just the appearances that are recorded for us. We don't have a clue how many other people Jesus may or may not have appeared to. Okay? He appeared to a lot of people. A lot of people saw him after he was raised from the dead. And there was a reason for that. We spoke about the reason last week. Do you remember what we said? The very fulcrum, the pivot point of whether or not the teaching that Jesus did while he was here, the teaching that the apostles have done since he left, the Bible, the very pivot point, all hinges upon one fact, And that's the fact of his resurrection. If Paul says it, if Christ is not raised, we amongst all the world are the biggest fools, the most pitiable, because we are putting our faith in something that never happened. That's why, excuse me, when the eunuch said, I want to be baptized, Philip's answer was, do you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the anointed one, the Son of the living God? Do you believe that he was raised? That's the pivot point. And so Christ went throughout wherever he went and appeared to people so that there was actual physical proof. And I want to kind of emphasize that point again. We talked about it last week. It was the physical body of Jesus that came forth out of the grave. It wasn't some ghost. And yeah, he appeared and disappeared as per his desire, but it was his actual physical body that was appearing. You know, Star Trek thought they had the thing on Beam Me Up, Scotty. Nah, Jesus was doing that 2,500 years ago or whenever, okay? He was being transported wherever he chose. But it was his physical body. They could touch the holes in his hand and the holes in his side. They could see the marking that had been left from the beatings and the torture that he had endured. And it was done for the reason to support faith in him. John tells us that that's why he wrote his book. Could somebody please find John chapter 20 and read for us verses 30 and 31. John 20, 30 and 31. Okay. What we see is a pattern being established here for us. Many other signs and wonders Jesus did in the presence of his disciples. So what is John implying that the miracles, the signs and the wonders that were done, why were they done? Prove it to who? To you, to me, Iris. If I believe, I'm going to go share that with somebody else, aren't I? I told James, he's up in Stockton a couple days a week now. I said, you need to go to Dave Wong's Chinese restaurant. Got the best lemon chicken in the world. I believe that. So because I believe that, I share it with James, who I know is in that area. Okay? It's something I believe, and I'm going to share that. Do you believe Jesus is just exactly who Jesus said he was and who John says he is? That he is the Christ? Do you believe that? There's step one in the process, belief. Where does belief come from? Hearing God's word. This is what tells me about Jesus. And friends, I got to tell you something. When Philip taught the eunuch, he taught him Jesus. He didn't go into a major discussion on why we meet on the first day of the week instead of Saturday. He didn't go into a major discussion of why we don't use musical instruments or why we take the Lord's Supper every first day of the week. None of that's indicated in Acts chapter 8. He taught him Jesus. Now, I would say this. maybe part and parcel to teaching Jesus is touching on those other things, but only peripherally by saying Jesus has given us a pattern, God has given us a pattern for how he wants his worship service. But it all, again, comes back to that pivotal hinge, which is Jesus, his life, death, and resurrection. Do you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? And if you do, what's preventing you from responding in faithful obedience? And you see, that's really what John is saying. A lot of other things Jesus did, do you believe them? And if you believe them, what's it say? That you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. There's only one way to get to that life in the name of Jesus Christ. Somebody please find Acts chapter 4, verse 12. And what name is that? Jesus the Christ. Therein is salvation. Believing you may have life in his name. That name, where it's the only place you can go to find salvation. And Jesus is very plain. We looked at it in John chapter 14 and verse 15. Do you love me? Keep my commandments. It's that simple. And the commandment that we have is to be faithful, be obedient. Obedient in all things. Baptism being just one of those things we need to be obedient in. But you see, if we establish that principle on the front end, then whomever that we might be talking to says, well, what about this? I don't know. Is that being obedient to the Scriptures? What do the Scriptures say? And if the Scriptures say, yeah, that's what we're to do, then yes, we're to engage in that. That's being obedient. If the Scriptures don't say that's something we're to engage in, then we shouldn't, because that's also being obedient. I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, my dad told me that there were things I could do and things I couldn't do. In his mind, obedience was one thing. That's my response to his commandments. Obedience, whether he said it was okay to do it or he said I couldn't do it. I had just one thing I had to worry about. I obey. Obey him saying I can or obey him saying I can't. It's all the same thing. It doesn't change. Obedience is my response to God's commandments, whether they be positive or negative. So that's the point that John is making in verses 30 and 31. Any questions there before we move into chapter 21, which is going to be the last of our discussion? We'll go back to Matthew and Mark a little bit, but this will be the ending of our discussion here. Any questions or comments? Michael George, could you lead us in prayer, please? Amen, and thank you. Okay, and when Michael said, thank you for waking us up, I immediately thought of my phone, because that's where I set my alarm. And if you've got your phone with you, please shut it off. Silence it, throw it on the ground, stomp on it, whatever you do. I don't know. Okay, question 13. Again, as I mentioned, Taylor defines this as the seventh appearance, and in terms of those appearances that we have recorded, yes. It's like our discussion about the sayings of Jesus on the cross. We say that there were eight sayings. He might have said something else. We don't know. What we know is these are the ones that are recorded for us. So we just kind of need to keep it in mind that we can't be dogmatic about something that we don't know. This is the seventh recorded appearance for us. Okay? Where did it take place? We're in John chapter 21, verse 1, just by the way, for everybody. Where did the appearance take place? The Sea of Tiberias. Where is that? It's the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee had multiple names. We just mentioned one, Sea of Galilee. It was also called the Sea of Tiberias. It was also called the Sea of Chinnereth, which you may have heard. And there may have been other names, don't know. We know some things about the Sea of Galilee. And if you've ever looked at a map that shows the waterway connection, up at the top, you have the Sea of Galilee. Then you've got the River Jordan that flows down through this Jordan Valley, River Jordan River Valley. And where does it end up? It ends up in the Dead Sea. We actually have a song in our book about that. There is a sea which day by day receives the rippling. And I've got the melody off a little bit, but it's talking about these life-giving streams that flow in to the Sea of Galilee. And then it carries life as it flows down the Jordan River Valley. But when it gets to the Dead Sea, because there's no outlet, the water just sits there and becomes stagnant, and it dies. There are no fish in the Sea of Galilee. They can't live. It's become... Go ahead. Oh, pardon. I said, yes, you're right. The Dead Sea. It's kind of like the Salton Sea that we have. Where is it? In Arizona or New Mexico, somewhere over in there? It's that way. Is it California? Huh? Okay. Yeah, and it's a Dead Sea. There's no outlet, so water comes in and nothing comes out. And that's what the song talks about. It's very interesting. Okay? And the example that's being used is that it gets life. Now, because of the way the Sea of Galilee sits, and it's kind of an elongated, goes north and south, it creates a vast wind tunnel. And the wind just whips down through there. And I don't know if you've ever had opportunity to be at San Luis Reservoir. Okay? It's... in a very small way, the same effect. It's a wind tunnel. The wind blows in through the pass there off of, what's the pass there called? Pacheco? Yeah, it blows down through Pacheco Pass, and it hits that reservoir, and it just goes, whoosh. And if you happen to be fishing on that lake, and you hear the siren, head to shore. Because it's not going to be a very long time, and I mean just moments, where you're going to have 3 to 5 foot waves flowing across San Luis Reservoir. And it will swamp your boat. It'll put you down. Now take that and blow it up immensely, and that's the Sea of Galilee. And that's why when we read the story about the disciples being out in the boat and the storm had come up and why they were so scared, that's why. There are recorded waves flowing through the Sea of Galilee that 4 to 8 feet just from the wind. That'll take a little boat down. But they're there. The disciples are there at the Sea of Tiberias, the Sea of Galilee. And verse 1 tells us that he manifested himself in this way. So, who was there? Okay. And? The sons of Zebedee. and two other disciples. So we've got Peter, Thomas, Nathaniel, James, John, and we don't know who the other two disciples were, but that's seven out of the existing 11. So there were only four that weren't there. Okay? What are they doing? We're going fishing. Was it just because they had the urge to fish? Why? They need to live. This is their job. This is what they do for a living. They are fishermen. Okay? It's not like I would tell Karen, hey, I'm going out on the boat to do some trolling. You want to go? It's not because I like fish. I don't. I don't eat the nasty things. But I enjoy fishing. And I think what I enjoyed the most was just tootling around on the boat. And every now and then I might not even put a lure on the line. I just let it flop out there. I enjoyed that. My dad loved to fish. That's not what they're doing. They're going to work. Okay? So, he says, I'm going fishing. And they all said, well, we'll come with you. And so they went out, got into the boat. And how much did they catch that night? Absolutely nothing. A little clue about fishing, and we used to do this up at Shaver. If you take a light at night and you shine it down into the water, that light attracts little teeny fish, you know, the little thingies like that. They kind of gather around it because you know what else light attracts? Bugs. Right? You've all been around a campfire. You've all been sitting out on your patio. Bugs come, and when they land on the water, the little fish are eating the bugs. Well, because the little fish are there, guess what else is attracted? Big fish. Night fishing is a very popular thing. And one of the practices that these fishermen at night would do was they would light torches. And they would put them around their boat so that it became a source of light. Bugs would be attracted. They'd land on the water. The little fish would come and the big fish would come. And it's just a dynamic. It's kind of an interesting thought. They're fishing at night. They haven't caught a thing. What happens? They're coming back to shore, and who's waiting for them? Jesus. Four. When the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach. But the disciples didn't know who it was yet. And Jesus said, children, which is just a common form of address, says, you don't have any fish, do you? Yeah, thanks for the reminder, you know. My dad's fishing partner was my Uncle Bud. Bud, and I think it was something about his body odor. That man could catch fish like no one you've ever seen in your life. My dad, not so much. My dad was a good fisherman. But they would go out fishing. And as they were coming in, Uncle Bud would look at my dad and say, how many you got on the line? And he'd hold up the stringer of fish. Drove my dad nuts. Jesus looks at the disciples, said, you didn't catch any fish, did you? And they all said no. He says, now cast your net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you will find fish. Is there a significance to casting your net on the left side as opposed to the right side? I never did any net fishing, so I can't answer the question from personal experience. But I know this, when I'm bait casting and trying to catch bass, you might not catch anything there and turn around and here and start hitting them. Don't know why. Just one of the things about fishing. So they cast their nets, and they weren't even able to haul the net in because of the enormous amount of fish that were within the net. That doesn't happen very often. Even with commercial fishermen who are putting out nets, to gather so many fish within the net that you can't even haul it in, that's mind-blowing. That's something that just doesn't happen. Verse 7, the disciple therefore whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It's the Lord." And so when Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put his outer garment on, for he was stripped for work, and he threw himself into the sea. But the other disciples came in the little boat. There goes Peter jumping in the water again. You know, good old impetuous, spur of the moment, I'm spontaneous Peter. I think sometimes it would be wonderful to have that kind of a response and a reaction to the Lord. That when somebody says, North is going to have a Bible, they're going to have a meeting, and I just can't wait to get there to listen to it, or Clovis or Merced or wherever, that I can't wait to go. That kind of, I'm that excited to hear about Jesus. It would be nice to have that kind of excitement just for coming to services, just for joining the Bible classes that are offered during the week. Eric?
So, I had to ask the question and I looked it up, but I think I know the answer. It says that he was joined with two other disciples that were not named. But then in 7 it says, therefore that disciple whom Jesus loved. Who's that?
Okay, the disciple that Jesus loved is typically referred to as John. Now, there's some discussion as to whether the sons of Zebedee, James, and is it James and John? Yeah. Is that the same John? We don't know.
Well, I find it interesting. One of the commentaries that said that you had talked about Peter being impetuous, but the scriptures talk about John reached the tomb first before Peter reached the tomb, that perhaps Peter didn't want to be outdone by John again by not meeting the Lord.
Yeah, I've always heard that John was the faster runner, for whatever that's worth.
He wore Nike shoes.
Yeah, he was wearing Nikes. Peter had Adidas. There's no comparison. Okay, so Peter jumps in the water, coming to Christ. The other disciples came in the little boat. And really what that's kind of talking about is all of these boats carried dinghies and not the people that were working on the boat, but a little rowboat kind of a thing that they would actually use when they were spreading their nets and or bringing them in, that they would have workers that were in the little boats to help with that, and then also to come in and into shore and then go back out. And in fact, that's what verse 8 says. They were not far from the land, but about 100 yards away, dragging the net full of fish. Okay? Because they couldn't bring it in the boat. Now, you're in a boat. Here's the shore. Here's the water. You're coming in a boat across the water, and you're dragging this net full of fish. What's going to happen? It's going to hit the bank. It's going to hit the underwater. It's going to ground itself. And that'll tear up the net and you'll lose the fish. Okay? So, they left the boat about 100 yards offshore and they came to shore in the little dinghy. little bits of trivia, not really important, other than if somebody asks, the scriptures give us the explanation. So, when they got upon the land, they saw a charcoal fire already laid and fish on it and bread. So Jesus had put out dinner for them. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish which you have now caught. So Peter went up, drew the net to land full of large fish, 153. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Interesting account. Jesus still, let me back up. I'll ask you, what do you see in this account? What's going on?
The miracle of the fish being caught.
Miracle of the fish. The miracle that their nets weren't torn. Miracle that Jesus was there and where he got the bread and the fish to lay out for him. What else?
Obedience.
Okay. Their obedience to his word. They didn't even know it was the Lord. He said, throw your net on the other side of the boat. And they did. Now, they were a long ways offshore. It says that they were 100 yards here when they got in the little boat to come to shore. That's a long ways, folks. That's a football field. You're standing at one end of the football field, and you're trying to talk to people standing at the other end of the football field. I have done that. I was the drum major of the band. And there were many times when we would split the band so that there were people coming in from one side and people coming in from the other. And I had to make myself heard across 100 yards of football field with screaming memes in the stands. Fortunately, I don't have much of a problem doing that, even back at that day and time. But you have to yell pretty loudly to get people to hear you and understand what you're saying. Okay? Jesus is on the shore. They're out in the boat 100 yards out, and he's talking to them. Picture walking out this door and Johnny running out there by the back fence and you standing here and you trying to talk to Johnny. I have a hard time hearing you when you talk to me sitting there. And that's not very far. Of course, I'm probably getting hard of hearing, which my wife would affirm. Okay? Jesus is talking to them. So there's a miracle in the fact that they heard him. Right? He made his voice heard 100 yards out over water. There's something else that we see. Jesus had done what for them? He'd made the fire, had food ready, bread and fish. Again, he is showing his care and his concern for them. And in doing that, what is he teaching them to be? Servants. This is Jesus the Christ. He's the Son of God. And he's waiting on them, serving them. That's the greatest example you and I can have of what it means to be a servant. Jesus was a servant to them. Okay. Questions or comments? We've answered questions 14 and 15. Also 13. Okay. Yes.
Back, he was physically himself
Right.
So there's more evidence of his, of the truth of his resurrection, that he was able to perform miracles and just to, you know, they couldn't just say, well, he's an impostor.
Right.
He did miracles.
Yeah.
But he looked just like Jesus. He wasn't.
He's just got some really good makeup artists. No, good point. Okay? So then Jesus says to them, come have breakfast. None of the disciples ventured to question him, who are you? Meaning that they recognized and understood this was in fact Jesus. Jesus came and took the bread and gave them and the fish likewise. This is the third time that Jesus was manifested to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. So, we've already looked at the other two. This is the third time. And again, he is supplying them proof so that they would then be able to go out and perform the task that was going to be laid upon their shoulders, which was what? Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. And the term apostle is defined as what? One who witnesses. Yeah. They had to, and that's why when you look in Acts chapter 1, what were the qualifications for someone to be an apostle? Had to been with Jesus from his baptism until his ascension. They had to have seen the miracles John's talking about. They had to have heard him teaching. They were there. So, again, we don't want to get too hung up on numbers. Yes, there were 12. But apparently there were others that were there because there was about 120 in the upper room there in Acts chapter 1, that Matthias was chosen from. Okay? Now, we're coming down to a very interesting discussion. Could somebody please read verses 15 through 17? Okay. Greek language has multiple words that we define with one word, love. What are some of the words that are used from the Greek that are translated as love? Phileo, agapeo, sorge, eros. Okay. That's just four. They carry with them different ideas. The two primary words that are used in the scriptures are phileo and agapeo. Who knows the difference between the two? What do you mean by that? Okay. Anyone else? Phileo, oh, go ahead, Ethelene.
Agape is the love that we learn from God, and that's to have a concern for man.
Mm-hmm.
More like wanting to do or put best for that particular person. Phileo, I believe, is like brotherly love. Or, what's the other one? Family.
Well, those would both fall under either agapeo or phileo. Agape is, as Etheling was saying, it's the desire, the wanting for the best for the person or object loved. Okay? It's what Iris was saying for man. Phileo carries with it the same ideas, but it's a far more intimate, it's a deeper expression of love. So we're going to go back and read this, and we're going to plug in the two words because both are used in this passage. Jesus looks at Simon, the son of John, and says, "Do you love me? Do you agape me?" Peter's answer is, "Yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you." And I think I had my definitions backwards. Agape is the deeper, more intimate. Phileo is the more just like, you're my brother. Okay? Because the city of Philadelphia is a city of brotherly love. Yeah, go there and look for it. Okay? So Jesus says, "Peter, do you agape me?" Peter says, "You know I phileo you." The second time Jesus says, "Peter, do you agape me?" Peter says, "Lord, you know I phileo you." Do you see what's happening? The third time Jesus says, "Peter, do you phileo me?" And Peter understood. That is Simon Peter. Yeah. No. Those are one and the same. In fact, the New American Standard says when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter. He uses both names. So in the third instance, when Jesus says, "Peter, do you phileo me?" Peter heard the distinction. And he wept because he understood what Jesus was saying. And at that point, Jesus said, "Tend my sheep." Okay? Any questions through that? There tends to be some discussion, but when you break it down and look at the Greek and what the Greek is saying, and the difference between agape and phileo, this passage really kind of makes an impression. We started off this class by saying, do you believe in Jesus? Do you believe enough that it's going to motivate you to do something about it? Or do you just phileo Jesus? Think of him as a bud. Because if we agape Jesus, John 14 and 15, we will keep his commandments. That's it for today. We will pick up in question 16 next week. I'll try to get the material ready and going for James. And for those of you that may not have been here when we had the discussion, we are going to look at the non-Pauline epistles. James, 1st, 2nd Peter, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and Jude. So we will look at those books in our next study. Okay? Thank you all.